Hello, Exopolitics listeners. I'm R.V. Romero, Stellar Artistic Director of Exopolitics Radio. I'd like to thank you all for listening to our show and for taking an interest in the evolution of our planet and our species through Exopolitics Radio and the study of law and order in the universe. For over a year now, I've enjoyed working closely with your elusive host, Alfred Weber, on this fine production that we're proud to broadcast on a weekly basis and post free of charge on our website. Currently, I'm happy to say that in the last 90 days, ExopoliticsRadio.com has been visited by people in over 56 countries and 492 cities around the globe, including all 50 states in the U.S. During that time, we've averaged over 5,000 podcast downloads per show, and we're adding listeners every week with affiliates at Paranormal Radio, the Revere Radio Network, and most recently, Kansas City Online Radio. Now, I'm telling you all this to give you an update on how our show is progressing, and also to let you know that indeed, the number of intelligent people here on Earth who are catching on to the fact that there are other intelligent life forms in the universe is growing. And Exopolitics Radio is proud to be on the cutting edge of this revelation by reporting news and providing the insight and perspectives that you can't find anywhere else on the radio, in the newspapers, or on the television. We want to continue bringing you Exopolitics Radio both online and on air free of charge, as we always have, because we believe in the message and the content. However, as a studio and production team, we do have routine expenses which must be maintained in order to do so. It pains us to ask, and I promise we won't do it often, but if every listener online donated $1 a month, that would completely cover our production costs for the show and the immense amount of time spent doing research, interviews, and production time given graciously by our host. Of course, not every listener is going to be able to donate $1 or donate on a monthly basis, so if you could consider donating a little bit more, that would be a tremendous help and allow us to continue adding more and more affiliates, creating new programs, interviews, and materials, and most importantly, continue broadcasting this message of hope and truth around the globe and the universe. So whatever the outcome, I can promise you that we will continue working to bring you a unique and sincere program week in and week out, 12 months a year. So we thank you for your support of Exopolitics Radio. Please remember to go to www.exopoliticsradio.com and click on the donate menu option for more information. Thank you very much, and now back to the show.
The views expressed on Exopolitics Radio with Alfred Weber are those of Alfred Weber and not specifically those of 1480 KPHX or our sponsors. In 1944, Nazi Germany created the V-2 rocket military program. The rocket reached 100 kilometers, also known as the boundary to space.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection. Russia has demanded UN action to get all foreign military personnel out of Greece.
October 4, 1957. Under the mission name Sputnik 1, the USSR launches the first artificial satellite to be put in geocentric orbit. December 19, 1958. American President Dwight D. Eisenhower.
This is the President of the United States speaking. Through the marvels of scientific advance, my voice is coming to you from a satellite circling in outer space. Through this unique means, I convey to you and to all mankind America's wish for peace on Earth and goodwill.
April 12, 1961, Russian Yuri Gagarin is the first man to travel into space aboard the rocket Vostok 1. May 25, 1961, American President John F. Kennedy.
Now it is time to take longer strides. Time for a great new American enterprise. Time for this nation to take a clearly leading role in space achievement, which in many ways may hold the key to our future on Earth. I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
Phoenix, Arizona, March 13, 1997. A mysterious formation of lights is seen hovering above the city. This incident, later known as the Phoenix Lights, was witnessed by, among others, Dr. Lin Ki-tai.
We call it the Phoenix Lights, but in fact, on March 13, 1997, while thousands of people happened to be looking up at the sky for a glimpse of the Hale-Bopp Comet, which was very clear in the northwest sky on a very quiet, beautiful March evening, they also witnessed a 1 to 2 mile wide formation of light. Some people say that they actually saw a craft traverse right over their heads, about 30 miles an hour, like gliding right over their heads, very low altitude. Some people did see it take off at a tremendous speed. Incredible technology, to be sure. And what was very eerie for most people was that it was totally silent. It was just a phenomenal parade that went through the state, from upstate Arizona all the way down to Tucson and then back to Phoenix. And this is over many hours.
Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio, KPHX Phoenix, 1480 AM, Nova M Radio, 1480kphx.com. Our audio archives are at www.exopoliticsradio.com. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. We're now in the first program in our creative mini hiatus of summer 2007. It's a short hiatus that we take at Exopolitics Radio between our season 1 of 13 programs and our season 2 of 13 programs to let the creative juices regenerate. And while they're regenerating, we bring you programs that are the best of Exopolitics Radio and segments that you may not have heard. And you've just heard Dr. Lin Ki-tai and the segue in our first Exopolitics Radio program, The Cosmic Trigger, of March 10th, 2007. And this is a special creative program that we're bringing on the Phoenix Lights, featuring remarks, as we said, from Dr. Lin Ki-tai, Dr. Michael Sala, Dr. Stephen Greer, Stephen Bassett, the executive director of XPAC, and our Washington, D.C.-based commentator, and yours truly, Alfred Weber, commenting on the Phoenix Lights and the revelations of former Governor Fife Symington of Arizona. And if what Dr. Stephen Greer says is true, that in fact the Phoenix Lights was an intentional sort of signal by extraterrestrial civilizations to a group gathered in the U.S. Congress concurrently with that. I mean, we don't know whether that's the case or not. Certainly it was a signal to the state of Arizona and to the U.S. authorities, who were well aware of it, and to the people of Arizona and to the government officials of the city of Arizona, such as the deputy mayor who stood up and did it, and the then governor, Fife Symington, who caved and ran a disinformational press conference, although to his credit, 10 years later, he came forward. Well, what's very interesting is that 10 years later, almost to the date, March 10th, 2007, Exopolitics Radio launched with our initial program on the Phoenix Lights. And that's been almost as a cosmic trigger to events which have subsequently happened. Within a week or days of our first program, the former governor of Arizona flipped and came out of the closet and said, "Hey, I really saw that 2-mile-wide spacecraft. I was just running a disinformation scam while I was governor." Then, 3 weeks later, on March 22nd, the government of France became the first nation to open its secret UFO files. And on May 2nd, the United Kingdom became the second nation on Earth to open its secret UFO files, although strictly Brazil, Mexico, Peru, and Chile had opened their secret UFO files prior to that. So I guess the French and the Anglo-Europeans count as more nations than the South Americans. Well, we'll see about that. At any rate, welcome to our Creative Hiatus show. You'll really enjoy it. Have your own Creative Hiatus. Tell your friends about our program. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after the break. Welcome back. This is your host, Alfred Weber. We'll now have Dr. Michael Sala of the Exopolitics Institute and Dr. Stephen Greer of the Disclosure Project with their insights and comments on the Phoenix Lights. As you know, March 3rd, 1997 marked the 10th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights phenomena in Phoenix, and we're on KPHX in Phoenix, and I wanted to ask you, jumping in again with both feet, whether you thought that the Phoenix Light phenomena, was that a black budget craft, an extraterrestrial craft, or perhaps a mixed human extraterrestrial craft? What is your opinion on that?
I think the Phoenix Light phenomenon, judging from the size that people have reported, and there have been a number of different witnesses and film and photographs offered, but they seem to focus on an incredibly large craft that's approximately a mile in width. And if that is the correct estimate of the size, well, then I think that would qualify it for being an extraterrestrial vehicle. There are flying triangles that have been created through black budget funding. The estimate for the size of those is approximately 200 yards, 600 feet. Edgar Fouché, a whistleblower, former engineer, spoke at length about the flying triangles, the TR-3B, and that is using those budgetary funds from the black budget to create a craft that uses anti-gravity technology. So that would account for why a craft flying triangles seem to move very slowly or seem to make no noise, and that these have been sighted throughout the US and in places in Scotland and Europe. But I think in the case of the Phoenix, if the size was a mile, then we are probably looking at an extraterrestrial vehicle.
Well, now, one particular example of a CE5 event in your book that you mentioned was really quite startling to me, and I think will be very much appreciated by our audience, because our anchor station is KPHX 1480 AM in Phoenix, Arizona, and Phoenix just celebrated the 10th anniversary on March 13, 2007 of the Phoenix Lights, and we've had special programs with Dr. Lynn Katai Dr. Rebecca Hardcastle speaking about the Phoenix Lights, and I wondered if you could share with our listeners some of the backstory that you reveal in your book, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, about the CE5 events that were transpiring 10 years before that date on March 13, 1997, around Phoenix.
Well, it's interesting because we were, the context of this trip, by the way, as you know, in 1997, a couple weeks later, we convened the briefings for Congress, Pentagon, and White House staff on the UFO ET issue and the need for disclosure. And this is when I had the first dozen or so of these military witnesses and a lot of evidence being presented. And this was a closed meeting, and we had chairman of committees there and other ranking, senior ranking people in the Congress and a government of the United States present. And it took place at the Westin in Georgetown. But in preparation for that, we were putting together the best available evidence that we could that were photo images and video images from all over the world and from all the way back from the 40s up until that moment. And We were going to a place. We had a picture editor for the BBC, Neil Cunningham, God bless him, came all the way from London to Phoenix to meet me and my assistant, Sherry Adamek, there to do the editing of all these thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of images that we'd collected from all over the world into a master reel that we were going to give to each member of Congress and the White House and all these people who were there. Well, as I was approaching Phoenix, I was sitting on a U.S. Airways flight vectoring into the Sky Harbor Airport, and it was about 5:30 in the afternoon or so, and I went into the CE5 protocol. I went into meditation, went into deep space, and saw these ET vehicles, some of whom had a connection to that area, to the Arizona area. And I asked them that if they could appear that night while we were there, and so that we could get some new and up-to-the-minute footage to give the members of Congress, that I would really appreciate it. Now, we landed, and I felt that very clearly a connection had been made. 3 hours later, we were in Tempe, Arizona, at a digital lab, putting all this stuff together, when someone rushed in and said, there's a huge craft right outside. And, of course, they had, and it was being filmed. And that was the Phoenix Lights of March 13th, 1997. So the background on this that I often haven't told because people find it incredulous is that it was a CE-5. But it was a CE-5 for a purpose. We were asking the ETs to do something that would be unmistakable, that the masses would see, and that it would result in photographic or videotape evidence that we could put into this master reel that we were putting into the hands of chairmen of key oversight committees of the U.S. Congress. And they showed up. So I tell people, you know, you don't know what's going to happen until you ask for it. And I'm the kind of person who just will say, well, let's ask for it. And you'd be surprised how often it does occur.
Well, that was a CE5 exercise, which certainly has had vast repercussions, both back in 1997. It was covered by all of the major media. In this remaining minute, could you, you know, give us your vision more of what you mean by this phase transition?
Well, you know, it's really like the separation between one phase and another. We're at the end of one long, I consider, multi-hundred-thousand-year era of human evolution, and the dawning of one that's another half-a-million-long era of human evolution. And so we're in this transitional phase, and that's why there seems to be so much chaos. And what people need to see is that, like in any physics experiment, if you talk about coherent phase transitions, it only takes about 1% of the molecules to become coherent for the entire substrate to shift and for it to become orderly. So what we have to do is aspire to be those islands of coherence, each of us, with the vision of where we're headed. And where we're headed is that we're headed into a time where we are going to be living on this planet as a peaceful civilization. We're going to be traveling in space peacefully. We're going to be using these wondrous technologies that have been kept secret. There will be the end of poverty on Earth as we know it, and the dawn of just unimaginable abundance, and that this is the time that we're in. We're in the time of the fulfillment of the potential of the human race, and we are, in fact, eventually going to become extraterrestrials ourselves, traveling amongst the stars. And so that's where we are, and yet we live also with one foot in this other time that is like sucking down, going down the drain. And we have to extricate ourselves from that and turn ourselves, our vision towards the future and the good future and manifest and create that good future, because that's the only way it ever happens. And when enough people do that, we'll be there.
Listen, we've come to the end of our segment, but if any of our listeners would like to find out more or to get in contact with you to become involved in this work, how can they do so?
They can reach me through a disclosure project. .org, that's all one word, disclosureproject.org, or csetti.org, csetti.org. And at csetti.org, they can learn about these Ambassador to the Universe training programs. And we welcome everyone to learn about this and to join us, because when enough people move in one direction in a positive way, it has an enormous effect, like a hunter's monkey effect, on people all over the world and all throughout the universe that we may not never meet, but it still has a positive effect.
Well, we certainly want to thank you, Stephen, for your work, and thank you for being with us, and we look forward to your being with us again on Exopolitics Radio. We've been with Dr. Stephen Greer, the director of the Disclosure Project, discussing many concepts and his most recent book, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. Thank you, Stephen.
This is your host, Alfred Weber, and this is the official ExoPolitics Radio commentary on the Phoenix Lights. ExoPolitics Radio launched on March 10th, 2007, 3 days shy of the 10th anniversary of March 13th, 1997 to March 13th, 2007, of the Phoenix Lights, in which a gigantic 1 to 2 mile wide spacecraft flew over the entire state of Arizona. Well, since our radio broadcast, I don't know whether this is coincidental or causal, journalist Leslie Kane reached former Arizona Governor Fife Symington, who now, in a story published on Sunday, March 18, 2007, and then in the March 21st Arizona Republic, and now we learn that it's soon to be covered by CNN, Symington now claims that on the night of March 13, 1997, he saw a large triangular craft of unknown origin. He says, quote, "It was dramatic, and it couldn't have been flares because it was too symmetrical. It had a geometric outline, a constant shape," Symington is quoted as saying. He goes on, "It was enormous and inexplicable. Who knows where it came from? A lot of people saw it, and I saw it too." Now, people ask him why he did that spoof, a press conference in which an aide dressed up as an alien. Well, he says that the state police agency, the Arizona Department of Public Safety, they were perplexed and offered no explanation. He says Arizona was on the brink of hysteria. And so, quote, "I never felt that the overall situation was a matter of ridicule. Quote, I wanted them to lighten up and calm down, so I introduced a little levity." And that is the explanation now after these years. Now, we understand that the political rumor mill is that former Governor Symington, who was pardoned by former President Bill Clinton after he was convicted in the savings and loan scandal and had to resign from the governorship, may want to run for political office in Arizona in a few years. And, of course, one knows that being a UFO witness is a successful strategy to political office. And we have, of course, the example of President Jimmy Carter, who in 1969 saw a UFO in the company of ten or so members of the Leary, Georgia Lions Club. He reported it publicly while he was governor of Georgia in 1973. And when he ran for president in the 1976 presidential campaign, he publicly stated that if he were elected president, he would release all of the files. Of course, he won on that platform, on an open the extraterrestrial files platform. When he came into office, it was another story, and he failed to do so. And President Jimmy Carter, to everybody's mystery, is quoted in a recent issue of Gentleman's Quarterly saying that he doesn't believe that extraterrestrials visit Earth. So I've spoken to many people. I've corresponded with journalist Leslie Kane, and everyone seems to think that Governor Symington's public statements are genuine and heartfelt, that he is a genuine witness to the Phoenix Lights. And so let's all go with the highest thought here, so that the launching of ExoPolitics Radio and the coming forward of Governor Symington and all of the events of disclosure that are beginning to come about now, which are a decade after the Phoenix Lights, a 2 mile wide spacecraft of as yet unknown origin, which traversed the state of Arizona, that this will be the first year of a decade of contact, which will result in a peaceful, sustainable, cooperative, new energy-based, space-age, galactically oriented human society. Let's all hope that. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after the break with our exciting Exopolitics program. Thank you. This is Exopolitics Radio, 1480 AM, KPHX Phoenix, www.1480kphx.com on the internet. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Today we have a very special guest, Stephen Bassett. He is a pioneer in the Exopolitics movement. Stephen Bassett is the organizer of the X Conferences 1 and 2 in Washington, D.C. in 2004 and 5. He is the executive director of XPAC, the Extraterrestrial Phenomenon Political Action Committee, and the only registered lobbyist with the U.S. Congress on behalf of the extraterrestrial community. His work has been referenced in, among others, the Washington Post, Washington Times, New York Times, Legal Times, Christian Science Monitor, National Journal, Pravda, London Sunday Express, The Hill, Washington, D.C., and O'Dwyer's Washington Report. So Steve is well familiar with mainstream politics as well as exopolitics. Steve has worked with the late Professor John Mack of Harvard University and was a candidate in 2003 for the U.S. Congress in Maryland on an exopolitics platform. Now, this is the 10th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights, and Steve was also a key figure in the exopolitics of the Phoenix Lights and in the role that Councilwoman Frances Barwood and other public officials played in those events. Steve, welcome to Exopolitics Radio.
It's good to be with you, Alfred, as always.
Well, tell us about the Phoenix Lights from your perspective. First of all, what exactly was your involvement in the Phoenix Lights?
What happened was that the event initially, for those that know the event, will remember well, that initially the event sort of emerged and then submerged quickly and was on its way to being another one of those sightings that happened and nothing really, no response, no authoritative response to it. So it just sort of slides back into, you know, the milieu. But something significant happened in this particular case. It was a significant sighting, though. It wasn't just a small one. It was a major sighting. Let's be clear about that. But what happened was that a politician did her job. I mean, it was one of those extraordinary moments when a person actually paid by citizens to serve them actually did that. It happens so infrequently now that we note it. And that person was, of course, Frances Barwood, and she had gotten quite a bit of email and people contacting her wanting to know what was going on with that and why wasn't there more response from the government. And she was troubled by that, and she was a bit of a maverick, definitely someone who is independent of mind. She's a Republican, but very much kind of a libertarian Republican. She did something so simple, it seems trivial now, but she simply raised the issue at the council meeting. She was the deputy mayor and possibly the head of the council at that time, chairman of the council, but I'm not positive to be deputy chairman. In any event, she was an established figure in Phoenix politics. She was on the council. She brought it up. Why didn't they investigate it? Why wasn't there a clear response to the people of Phoenix? I mean, there was something flying over here, apparently so, and big, large, in our airspace, all kinds of implications there, and yet the people were treated like children, meaning, oh, don't worry about it. It's too important for you to worry about. We'll take care of it, this type of thing. Bothered her. Well, when she did that, it created an immediate response, because that's mainstream. In other words, when the mainstream touches this issue, the press will tend to get in gear. And they did. And they came to her and started interviewing her and asking her, why did you do this? And there was, of course, some usual snide remarks from others generating additional publicity. And so all of a sudden, the issue's back in play again. To be clear, there was a very significant article that appeared in USA Today by Richard Price. This is an important article, they'll go down in history, in which they brought the issue up. And that also helped to bring it back into play. And so Frances now has got a problem. She's got all these people now talking about it, talking about what she did, and I think she needed to follow through. I mean, it would have been silly for her not to at that point. She was committed. So she continued to raise the issue. She started giving interviews. And then Fife Simonton, the now discredited governor of Arizona, ironically, he was under investigation for some real estate or financial transactions during this period, was indicted and actually went to prison not long after this issue sort of moved on. But before all that happened, he held a press conference to make fun of the whole thing. He made it into a gag, a joke. It was filmed. It's now indelibly, in the archives forever. He brought out a staffer with an alien head on and said, he's the person behind this all. We need to laugh at ourselves. Yuck, yuck, yuck. That increased the intensity. And, of course, we're talking about the Internet age. This was back in the mid-90s. So now the thing is fully in play. And I entered the picture because my political perspective on this was well known, and the principal person that intervened here and brought me and Barbara together was Richard Hoagland, interestingly enough. And so I started talking with her privately, and we were discussing the various aspects of all this and what it could mean and not mean, and she indicated she was going to run for lieutenant governor. And so we had some discussions, and essentially I made the case to her that I didn't know if she could win, become a lieutenant governor or not, but she had a chance to make some history if she were to bring this issue right along with her into that campaign. And she, to her credit, a very gutsy woman, she agreed to it. And I went out to Phoenix initially. We went over this, and then I came back and then went out again and began, when she gave the initial press conference in Phoenix announcing her candidacy, I actually initiated that. I started that off and indicated that the issue was going to be in play, and it was an important issue, and that she was going to raise it and talk about it in this campaign. And that was all well and good, but from that moment forward, everything changed. In other words, she was a formal candidate, and immediately she started coming under substantial pressure, like, oh, no, you can't do this. And it was a lot. I know it was a lot, because prior to running, the powers that be in Arizona desperately wanted her not to run for whatever reason, either because they didn't want her to be the lieutenant governor, or they didn't, forgive me, I've had a blank, it's either lieutenant governor or secretary of state. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it was secretary of state.
Secretary of state, forgive me, yes. Yeah. A significant position. And they didn't want her to be that, or they didn't want this issue in play, but they started offering her a position. They'd offer something, and then they'd raise it, and they'd offer something even more, and at the end they were offering her some very, very lucrative job in the state government to not do this, and she turned them all down and ran anyway. But once she announced this, and once this issue was in play, and this press conference that she gave is on film, I need to get a copy of that, it just changed, and she started coming under intense pressure from all sides, her supporters, her campaign manager, and she simply had to back out of it. And I withdrew from my position as an advisor and went back and did other things, and she went on with the campaign with that particular issue sort of in a much more limited contained position, a limited portion of her campaign, and not with the prominence that we wanted it to have. She did lose, but she lost in the primary, so she did not actually get on the ballot in November. And afterwards, she had an interesting career, and it had lots of ups and downs, and I think she was tired, and she and her husband withdrew sort of from public life and moved up in the mountains where they've had a very comfortable and pleasant life up there. And she keeps in touch with the issue and occasionally sends out an email. So essentially, Barwood is an example of a politician, one of many over the last 60 years, who intersected the issue in one form or another. And we could pick off a lot of names here, from Gerald Ford to Stephen Schiff to Eisenhower to Carter to Clinton. And I will say this, I know pretty much all of them. What I mean is I know all of these intersections that have occurred. I will say that Frances Barwood handled it better than just about any of them. From her position as just a basic councilwoman in a large American city, not only in that position, but also in her thinking about being a candidate, she did initially attempt to do this and bring it into play. Deserves a tremendous amount of credit for that. And I will always have a special place in my heart for Frances.
Well, this is a very moving account that you give, Steve, and I kind of want to go off into two different aspects of it, but just let's stick with her campaign because you were part of it and you were a political advisor to her, or shall we say an exopolitical advisor to her campaign for Secretary of State. Do you recall exactly what part of her platform, when she did announce for that office and did hold that press conference and did have certain campaign platforms, let's call it the exopolitics platform or the disclosure platform, was she talking specifically about the Phoenix Lights? Is that what she was running on, or was she running on a kind of broader disclosure or exopolitics agenda? Could you tell us more about that, just from an historical standpoint?
Well, the fact is, she was an established politician in Arizona.
Yeah.
She'd been around for a while, been involved in a number of issues. She was a Republican. She was, you know, I think a senior person on the city council. So when she ran, when she got in the race for Secretary of State, she was a real candidate, and so she had positions on all matters affecting the citizens of Arizona. Gun control, banking, finance, immigration, whatever. She had all that. But what she was willing to do, all she did was acknowledge that the emperor didn't have any clothes. And what we talked about focused primarily on the response of the government and the press to the issue. The government initially denied anything was significant. Then they said, well, yeah, we did pick it up on radar. And then they came up with a flare explanation for the later lights, but they never dealt with the earlier issue. Of course, we're assuming a lot of the people listening to this know something about the Phoenix Lights. If
right.
they don't, they're going to have to go to the Internet, and they're going to have to Google Phoenix Lights and read some of the material on that. There is plenty there. But let me just say, it's one of the major sightings in the history of the UFO phenomena,
right.
and probably the one of the top three major sightings in the history of the United States, easily. The point is that these responses were inappropriate. Luke Air Force Base, federal government, the National Guard, and the press, their response was inappropriate, and she was willing to say that. And that was her principal concern. She wasn't an expert on UFO phenomena. She didn't know that much about it, but she did know that something was rotten in Denmark with respect to how that event was handled. But, of course, what she was seeing is a kind of standard template that had been constructed by the government going all the way back to the 50s to address events like this to try to keep them contained. And she just happened to get a first-hand perspective on that as a politician, and it bothered her, and she's a gutsy person. She said, okay, I don't like this, and we're going to bring this up in the campaign. She'd also gotten a lot of responses from people that had seen the thing. So she'd gotten a lot of accounts that had, I think, convinced her that something extraordinary happened that night. In fact, when I first went out there to meet with her personally, I actually stayed at her house for a day or two. The day I got there, we're sitting there talking in the living room. She got a phone call. She went over and she took the phone call and went on for a bit and then came back. And she said, that was an interesting call. And I said, well, what was it? She said, well, I can't tell you any names or anything, but this was a pretty well-known CEO of a significant company based in Phoenix. And this person, I believe it was a he, just elected to call her and let her know that he and his wife apparently were out driving and they saw the earlier craft fly over their car. This huge, very large, 2, 3, 4 right. football field wide black triangle that blocked out the sky, flew over her car, and he couldn't go public with it, no way, but he just wanted to let her know. So she got that kind of input, and I think it made her convinced that, in fact, something profound had happened over Phoenix. So she was not, I think, in much doubt about that. But in terms of the totality of the extraterrestrial-related phenomena, which is vast, she was no expert. But she knew that the response from the government was unacceptable, so she spoke to it. And the government doesn't like that. I mean, boy, when politicians do that, they get upset because that's the kind of thing that could lead to a more extensive engagement by the media, more public interest, more public demands, and the cover-up and the truth embargo would come down. Now, this was 1997, I believe. And,
yes.
The campaign was in 98. It was a little early, though the exopolitical drama was starting to play out at a much more rapid pace, and so she was kind of timely in that regard, but still a little early with respect to what the government was going to do or not do. So she, again, her intersection lasted for about a little over a year from the time of the event through all the media that she got later that year, and then her campaign opening in 98, and then eventually ended. It really ended when the primary, when she lost the primary, I forget when the primary was, in 98, in Arizona, probably in April, May, something like that. So it was a one-year period, and I think she conducted herself well. She stuck to her guns, by and large, though in the campaign she had to pull it back. But it's okay. I don't criticize her for that. she did her part. She did more than her share and raised the issue. And for that reason, it still has life today. The Symington video of his ridiculous press conference is out there. Eventually, we'll get our hands on her press conference announcing her candidacy, and that will get up on the Internet, on Google or YouTube. In fact, I need to make that a project to get my hands on that. And so this is just, again, an example. Her experience was important educationally. The Phoenix Lights event itself, of course, was even more important. It was an extraordinary thing that could only be explained, in my opinion, by an ET craft or a government craft flying in that fashion. If it was a government craft, it raises all kinds of even more exotic issues in some respect. What in the hell were they doing and why? If an ET craft, then it was a message, all right? They don't need to do that. So they clearly wanted to stir the pot down here and create a fuss for reasons that we can guess.
Right. Well, there are some repercussions from the Phoenix Lights event that I think still go on today. And we can look at the Fife Symington press conference just a bit later, although that seems to me, having watched it on Dr. Lynn Kitai's very fine documentary on the Phoenix Lights, it seemed to me that that fit within the classic ha-ha game, i.e., that's a classic known disinformation technique. That was no college prank. That was no informal. That's a known technique by which, when a person of authority or responsibility or any other person has taken a stand in the past on the issue of the existence of advanced extraterrestrial civilizations in our environment, one of the prime standard operating procedures of the information embargo against extraterrestrial civilizations has been the tool of ridicule. And
definitely, and I don't disagree with you there. In fact, I wrote an article recently that gets into that called UFO RIP, which is published in a number of locations. I think it was in UFO Magazine, except the American Chronicle and elsewhere. I get into that, and I don't disagree with you, but I don't know whether it was or not. In other words, I do not know if Fife Symington simply did that or whether he was told to do that by some higher-up saying, look, we need to kind of put this down, so why don't you do this, Fife? I don't know. Only Fife Symington knows. But it clearly is an example.
Yeah.
But one of them mentioned something I almost forgot. Look, John McCain was involved here a little bit, too.
Right.
As a well-known senator, and obviously in Arizona, he got a lot of contacts about this. They were coming at him wanting to know what he thought and what we were going to do about it. And overall, McCain, to his credit, he did not put it down, though. And I don't know if he made any public written statements about it.
We're coming down to the last minutes in this very exciting segment. Both you and I know that one of the litmus tests from the exopolitics standpoint for the 2008 presidential election is how good a disclosure president would a certain person be. How good, in your opinion, would John McCain be as a disclosure president?
McCain has one thing going for him. He's a maverick, and a bit of an independent thinker. And so once in power, he actually had the presidency, and he was presented the case for disclosure. I think McCain has got the kind of thinking and approach that he could buck the system and do it, even if he was being advised by some significant parts of his government not to. He's also got the will, the guts. You know, I mean, he does have guts. I mean, in other words, he has a fundamental stiffness to him that would serve him well. Though, like all politicians, he bends often when he needs to. In fact, he's in the middle of changing his position in a way on this war right now. But Iraq war. So that serves, I think, it's helpful. He's a strong guy. He's also somebody that the military and the intelligence community, I think, generally would be comfortable with. They would like him. And I think in general, having a president that's somewhat respected by the military intelligence community is comforting to them as they consider the confusion and the uncertainty in a post-disclosure world, or the disclosure will create. They want a president they kind of like and are comfortable with, and that's positive. So it's not totally a negative. There are some positives there. But much more important than that is this. You're going to start seeing the beginnings of the campaign, and that's going to go all the way on to the primary, to the selection of the candidate next year. We're talking about a long period of time, and people need to get out there and ask him about it. He was a senator from Arizona. one of the most important sightings in history happened there. They need to ask him about his response, what he did do, what he didn't do, what he should have done. They need to ask him about what the government did, didn't do. They need to ask him all of the tough questions about that and hold his feet to the fire on it. And he can dodge and do whatever he wants, but at least that will tend to pin him down. And don't wait for him to become president. Push him real hard during the election, during the campaign season, at all these little gatherings and get-togethers and town halls and everything else. People have got to ask the questions. This is a project that I've been working on for years. Get out the questions.
Okay,
stand in front of the man and ask him an E.T. question. You're not going to turn to stone, and you're not going to be, you know, ridden out of town. You're not going to have, chocolate syrup dumped on you.
Steve, it's been a great pleasure. This is a tremendously exciting segment. Thank you.
My pleasure as well. You're welcome.
This is Alfred Weber. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Alfred Weber. Well, if Phoenix is rebirth, we're certainly having a rebirth in Phoenix, Arizona, with the Phoenix Lights. And that may well have been, under the context communication theory of extraterrestrial communication, an intentional signal from a ethical, advanced extraterrestrial civilization of a positive nature to wake up first 10,000 citizens of Phoenix, along with, you know, all the Air Force and the Congress and everyone else that was tuned into it in 1997. And then with the rebirth of it, you know, through the media in 1997, and the rebirth of it in 2007 with the 10th year anniversary as sort of a cosmic trigger, because now in 2007 that the exopolitics model landed in the year 2000 with the book Exopolitics, and followed by, in rapid sequence, once we opened that doorway, came the Disclosure Project in 2001, and came the X conferences in 2002 and 2004, and came the whole academic with Dr. Salen, you know, work in the years 2000, and then came the openings of all of the nations that since the year 2000, including Mexico, Chile, Peru, the UK, France, everybody but the USA. Well, that's going to start changing, because we're all going to gather in Washington September 14th to 16th, and then the 17th, 18th, and again, we're going to go march up to the Capitol. We're going to have our meeting. So those of you out in the audience who want to be there, please go to exopolitics.com, paradigmresearchgroup.com, get your tickets for the X conference in Washington, D.C., set up meetings with your congressman and or senator for that Monday or Tuesday, September 17th and 18th. And we will gladly, myself, Alfred Weber, Steve Bassett, Dr. Michael Sala, and others, we will accompany you to those meetings to meet with you and your senator, and we'll get this paradigm opening up like a blossoming rose. Exopolitics Radio is produced by Phoenix Productions in conjunction with 1480 KPHX Progressive Talk Phoenix and the Nova M Network. Executive producer Richard Romero Sr., director RV Romero, producer and editor Chris Romero. I'm your host, Alfred Weber, wishing you a wonderful, miracle-filled, and creative day, year, and life. Thank you.